This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 1st of November, 1955. The title of this lecture is The Preclear's Reality. This lecture is 61 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
Okay, this is November 1, 1955, 4th London ACC, first morning lecture. I haven't got a thing to talk to you about this morning. You've all become such excellent auditors. You've become so intuitive. Your touch has become so delicate. Your ability to rehabilitate the power of choice in the pre-clear has become so exquisitely interrupted. But it's a wonder to me you're still alive. Well, anyhow, we've had some auditing since we've been here. And I said 2 or 3 days ago that we should be auditing for blood now, and some of you have taken me literally. So, in view of the fact that you are having here and there case progress, I'm going to give you a technique this morning which will interrupt it, if possible. Well, you think I'm serious about that. As a matter of fact, the technique which I'm about to give you, misused, would probably kill an elephant. The greatest of ease. In view of the fact none of us are elephants, we're safe. It's a bad joke, but it's a bad morning. There is what is called a fog this morning. I wish to mention this. And we're also doing a record here this morning. And I don't want the London Chamber of Commerce to get too upset, but I was told last night while groping through various strata of coal smoke and fog that there was no fog to amount to anything and it would lighten up and get better. Well, as a matter of fact, it did get better within limits during the next few hours. But meteorologically speaking, I think what we're looking at out the window is fog. It isn't coal smoke. It is fog. And when you look through that fog, you probably can see with the greatest of ease what somebody is looking at through or like who is having no ability to perceive at all. And in view of the fact that nearly all of you have very good eyesight, you ought to turn around and look right now at that fog, and those of you that will hear this tape later, simply mock up some fog and look at it, and you will get some sort of an idea of how clear things aren't to some people. Now, it's very, very hard for a fellow who sees well to work close to and right in with a person who is seeing very poorly. Do you see that? In fact, we are just as you can see clearly right now, as I stand here fairly clearly in spite of some fog, you look out the window there and you see that mass of white. And you see that's the difference. Now, you might be standing there seeing very well, you see, and you're pre-clear standing there alongside of you seeing very poorly. And yet the pre-clear would have a face and eyes and a body and hair and a voice and so forth. And yet as you work with this pre-clear, he does not apparently get much better. Why? Because you haven't allowed for the fog factor, to use a technical word we won't use again. But that factor is simply this. That factor is the fact that you are conscious and he is slightly anatin. You're in total control of your faculties. He is not only not totally in control of his just by the fact of being audited, but at the same time is less aware and more dependent upon you to see for him. Now, if somebody came up to you while you were auditing this preclear and said, "Gab, gab, walla, walla, disconnect, non sequitur," it wouldn't bother you, but it'd bother your preclear. See that? In other words, what bothers the auditor would almost kill the preclear, and what doesn't bother the auditor at all may have a considerably impressive effect upon the preclear. Now, you sit there and you're talking pleasantly, and the nuances of your speech are easily recognizable to one and all, and you're hearing and you're seeing and you're bright and alert and in present time, and your preclear isn't. Just by the nature of the auditing, he isn't. You may be having him spot spots and so on, and he may be passing through an engram of one kind or another. He may be fogged up one way or the other, and his perception is not as clear as yours, and his ability to restrain the environment has been dropped to some degree for the purposes of examination of his bank. Now, the reason he couldn't examine his bank all by himself is a very simple one. He has to restrain the environment. He has to keep his guard up, you might say. But you come along, and you keep his guard up for him. All right, that's fine. So he lets his guard down. And then the next thing you know, a bad auditor lets the world fall in on his head. See how the world can fall in on his head. Well, you're standing in the sunshine and he's standing in the fog. You're conscious and he's inattentive. You're in present time and thinking with all your faculties, and he is introspecting. Now, an auditor doesn't recognize this. He leaves his preclear stuck all over the track because it's all right with him to suddenly cut in and say, "Well, do you feel like having some tea now?" How do you know where the preclear is? Maybe he's skidded down to the age of four. You say, "Oh, look at that silly hat over there." And he has just cognited on the fact that all women to him look like mother. You get the idea? I'm trying to give you a little look at the preclear's reality. And the preclear's reality during auditing is poor. And the auditor's reality during auditing is good. Now, sometimes the preclear's reality during auditing is as good as or better than the auditor's. But these moments are not completely predictable and are rare. So you just always assume to be on the safe side that the preclear is standing in the fog while you're standing in the sunshine. You see? And that strange objects coming up, strange shapes materializing before him, strange stimuli suddenly occurring, will not upset you, but they will certainly upset your preclear. Now, the wrong way to do this is try to restrain the entire environment from falling in on your preclear with some kind of a physical effort. Some auditors do this. I think it's absolutely necessary to protect the preclear from every sound and sight. They have screens up, you might say, around the preclear. And, of course, they're the auditor's screens, and they're not going to protect the preclear worth a nickel. The way you protect a preclear is quite some other way. You just keep him aware of you in a gentle fashion, and you do not bring about sudden changes which overset his power of choice. You do not intrude too heavily upon his anatin, but you still keep him coming along. Now, wherever you find a poor auditor, you find these conditions to exist. One, a case in poor condition. That's first condition you usually find. Two, you find an auditor who has no great reality on Scientology for some reason or other. Now, the fact that the person is auditing uncertainly and without a positive or definite touch does not mean that the person is natively uncertain. You see that? That does not mean the person is natively uncertain. It means he's uncertain of Scientology. You see, the person is uncertain of Scientology and audits uncertainly. And these are data of comparable magnitude. The certainty or uncertainty of the preclear is therefore changed by the auditor's certainty and uncertainty. Unless an injection of certainty can be put into the session by the auditor, the preclear becomes uncertain. And when we say uncertain, we mean retrogressed a little bit toward confusion. We have added to his fog. See that? All right. Now, as we look then at the auditor-preclear relationship, we find that the certainty of the auditor seems to carry with it better perception, better thinkingness, better alertness, and better ARC. Now, our thinkingness on the part of the preclear, the thinkingness which he is doing, is totally dependent on his auditor-preclear ARC. Totally dependent on it. He can think more into the reactive bank and into his own introspections if the auditor is certain. See? And if the auditor is uncertain or carries a sort of an uncertain aura or miasma, you see, then the preclear can't adventure very far into that. But if he does, his Q&A with the auditor is to be more uncertain of the material he's facing. In other words, the auditor is an additive factor to the preclear's bank during an auditing session. An uncertainty on the part of an auditor then re-echoes with the preclear. Now, the way to obtain certainty as an auditor, of course, is to obtain some good results from Scientology. Now, that's about the first and foremost statement you could make. But if this were not immediately possible, then certainly you would have to have some basic certainty. You would have to substitute for certainty in the subject to get the first result. See? So we don't necessarily have good results when we first start to audit, certainly. So there is another thing for which we can substitute. Another thing we can substitute here. And that thing is data certainty. And the way we obtain data certainty is to permit the auditor student to integrate the material of Scientology into former alignments of learning, to clarify those by the data in Scientology. Now, there are thousands of data in Scientology, thousands of them, all of which are fairly native to Scientology. I hear people say, well, somebody or other said that and somebody else said that. And you say, well, where's the quote? And you read the quote, and it's got 20 more words, and it's on something else, and it's talking about ornithology. See? The actual description of shifting of attention, fixing or unfixing attention, just as such, done as such, as a mechanical operation, happens to be native to Scientology. But it sounds quite like you have to give attention and concentrate in order to study, you know. I mean, we could Hobson-Jobson this around to the point where it didn't quite mean that. No, fixing and unfixing attention at will is an operation as such, which is fairly native to Scientology. You see, it's a very precise thing. Now, we know that students have to be able to fix and unfix attention at will on data, don't we? Therefore, where a student's background training included many years, as all of ours has, of mall practice in fixing and unfixing attention. You fixed attention as the professor told you to fix attention, and you damn well better had fixed your attention, or you were going to get an auto da fe known as an examination, you see? And you had to guess where he wanted your attention fixed. And to a large degree, we lost the power of choice over fixing and unfixing attention with relationship to bodies of data, which makes the data in later life relatively unusable. Thus, we have the odd picture. This, I, by the way, could never understand. We have the odd picture as a kid studying. This I could never just get through my thick skull. I mean, it was one of these things. We had students who would sit in class and study anything you wanted to name, and after class, couldn't do a thing with it. I remember the first time I ever had some Spanish. It was rather interesting that at such a low grade of school, that is to say in very early grades, to be taught some Spanish, but I was down in California, and it was right close to the Mexican border. And you ran into Spanish all over the place. And we were supposed to study some Spanish, you see, and it was nothing more than Buenos Dias and Hasta la Vista and this sort of thing, you know. But after class, I thought, this is fun. We're learning a new code language, you know. I'm learning a new code of one kind or another with which to converse. And I would say to the other kids in class, Buenos Dias, and they would look at me and they would say, huh? Well, this is fantastic. I couldn't understand this. Where had their Spanish gone? They sat in the same classroom with me. They heard the same teacher talk to them. But where had their Spanish gone? And I eventually, in the university, started to run into this so flagrantly that it became not a matter of curiosity, but a matter of some concern to me. We would walk into the some advanced class in physics or something, and we would listen to Halley's early equations or something of the sort, and why he did it, and find this perfectly interesting. I'd think about it a little bit and come out and talk to one of the students and say, you know, that Halley was a remarkable chap. I wonder if so-and-so and so-and-so, and this student would look at me and say, huh? And I'd say, well, we just studied about Halley. You know, what you heard in the lecture? Oh, yes. So fabulous that I used to go over as a freshman or sophomore over to the senior engineering planning division, something like that, and just hang around waiting for the seniors to ask me how to figure out something in calculus. Not because I wanted to be smart, because I knew they would. I knew that here where they were 4 or 5 years deep in their studies, and I knew that that was too long for them to remember their basic or freshman mathematics. Now, what the devil's going on? Part of it is that they consider that the study is for the classroom, and their attention is automatically fixed on the subject in the classroom. But the subject is for the classroom. Now, here's a total identification. The subject is not for outside the classroom. So if every subject they ever studied was still in the classroom where they studied it, I would like to know how they're ever going to apply it anywhere. And then I ask in vain amongst many educators on this business of the application of the education, and I find this astonishing reaction. Huh? The education in their turn was for the classroom and the grade book. This is so scandalous in our Western society that I could not shame a bunch of young officers with it one time. We had a British corvette, and I got myself a brand new issue of Ensigns, straight out of, issue Ensigns. They take them out of a university, and they throw them through an indoctrination school, and then all of a sudden, there they are on the bridge. And you haven't any watch officers. You haven't anything. You've got issue ensigns. Oh, this is fabulous. I suppose all of us have been young and new at something at one time or another, but this was more incredible than I cared to stomach because there was actually a war going on. It meant that I had to stand all the deck watches. And it put me to work, you see, so I fell across it very foul, and I never quite gotten over it. Because they would come on after an enormous amount of indoctrination and education, and they'd look around the bridge as though they'd never seen any part of it before. This bridge had never before existed. No item they had ever studied in their indoctrination school had any relationship to any item on that bridge. So in desperation, the first thing I did when they were standing watches and so forth, just to shame them, I started giving them grades for the kind of watch that they'd stood. And I posted it on the bulletin board, just a nasty, snappy, snide trick that only a skipper worked within an inch of his life would have done. Ensign Smithers, 12 to 4 watch, grade B. Ensign Smythe, 4 to 6 dog, grade D. Ensign Johnson, 6 to 8 dog, flunked. And you know, they thought it was a fine system. They came around and thanked me for it. They didn't know every man on the ship was in stitches over this. They thought it was an honest and sincere effort to better their watch standing. And so I cut loose. I cut loose and I ran them right straight back through as though I were educating a seaman second class. This is a wheel. This is a compass. It is commonly called a binnacle. You know, that sort of thing. I could have shot them. They appreciated it. But they learned it. They learned it. And they learned it for that bridge and that time for that purpose. And I'll bet you if they were ever transferred over to another ship, they forgot it. Why? The mystery of this, since the matter was so urgent at the time and so likely to be paid for in dead men, that my patience was poor. This, in other fields, has happened to me. I've had kids come aboard to, you haven't any idea how complicated a sailing vessel can be. I remember the first, you might say, command I ever had was a Doris Hamlin, 1,000 tons burthen out of Baltimore. Four-mast schooner, 200 feet between perpendiculars, twin deck. Lovely old ship. She had been built for World War I, and they had built her on cost plus 10, so her cabins were all walnut, and she was made out of oak, you know, the most expensive materials they could possibly get into her so they could get their 10% of them. And then it had never been finished during the war, but the contract was so written that it continued on and was completed after the war. So she was brought right up to after the war, and then she was sold for $4,000. Her rigging cost $120,000. And she had sat in the dead ship pool practically from then, except for a couple of minor voyages, right up to the time I picked her up for an expeditionary vessel and fitted her up with a bathysphere and underwater motion picture equipment and so on, and she was real good. And I picked up kids, fairly young kids, one kind or another, made a crew out of them. Her trucks were 125 feet above the deck, and that is high above a deck. That's high. You get all the way up to the topmost truck on something like that, and when you look down, and that truck is swinging, you see, and that mast is making huge, irregular swoops around the sky, you know. And that deck way down there is lilting this way and that way, and one moment you're over the sea to the starboard, and one moment you're over the sea to port. And it's quite high. Now, in order to tack, she was a topsail schooner. And in order to tack her, you had to bring her topsails across the chains, which is to say, you had to send somebody up to the main truck, mizzen and so forth, in order to unfasten a chain and fasten the topsail over on the other side. Otherwise, she would belly against the shrouds and so on. She would belly, actually, against, what do you call the Jesus sailing? The line which supported her boom. So you had to bring these around. In other words, four men had to go aloft, scamper like monkeys, every time you tacked across the wind. And believe me, in some passes, you tack often. But you know these young fellows had no difficulty whatsoever in learning this. They had no difficulty in doing this. And it was outside my sphere of understanding later on when I had difficulty in teaching anyone about an iron ship. Iron ships are kind of, a yachtsman that's fond of sailing ships calls all these motorboats stink pots, And running an iron ship around with big motors that always run, it's very adventurous, like driving a lorry. And the difficulties of learning one are so minor as to be ridiculous. There's nothing to learn about an iron ship with motors and engines and so forth. There's nothing much to learn. You can learn how to navigate them one way or the other. You can learn how to handle them alongside docks or at sea. But you never get into any real nautical difficulties with them. You're not suddenly taken aback and your wind doesn't suddenly veer on you, and you're not caught in a tide race with no wind. Your motive power is always assured. You never have to make judgment way in advance. Running a sailing ship, particularly of any size, is a matter, you've got to be half genius and half clairvoyant. And if you're those things, why, you sail them successfully. But an iron ship, you can be half idiot and still get away with it, you see. So if all these young men, which is all a point I'm getting down to, if all these young men that I had on the old Doris Hamlin could learn the tremendously complicated technology of sail, I would hate to tell you that the amount of technology there is, just names. I was trying to remember for a moment the topping lift and names of this character as they, the shrouds, sheets, the various parts of the sail, the various orders you have to give in order to handle sail. It's something that is sufficiently complex that every time you go around a sailing ship, you have to look her over, and she is, to a large degree, an individual. And you have to look her over carefully and find out just how she's situated and located. And you learn this in calm weather. You see, you don't wait until a storm comes up, because if you didn't know it thoroughly, the storm would sink you. It's just as sharp as that. Well, if these young fellows had no difficulty learning the tremendous complexities of sail, learning the tremendous complexity of steering a sailing ship, keeping her luff, spilling just a trifle, and steadying her up, you can steer a sailing ship just a little bit wrong and she'll stop footing. You lose two or three knots of speed with the greatest of ease. All you got to do is just hold her off the wind just slightly, and you've lost some of your speed. Or you just got to keep too much luff spilling and too much wind spilling out of the luff, and you starve her up, And you again lose speed. It's a real trick thing. And it's all up to the wheelsman. It's all up to the guy standing back there. He just got to keep her full and by, and he's all set. Well, all right. What then was the difference between these young fellows who could learn a complicated vessel and these characters that had a gold stripe hung on them and were issued to us in small bandboxes, who couldn't learn something which has an iron mic, if you please? You set your compass course and then leave the wheel, and it steers it forevermore till your engines run out of gas or you run aground. This is complicated, is it? You set a small dial. It says you are now going to steer 280. That's that. The ship, by electric motors, goes on and steers 280. There isn't any spilling the wind a little bit. There isn't anything complicated about this at all. It's idiotic. It's almost insulting to stand a deck watch on modern ships. The Queen Mary does everything but fan the officer of the watch with an arm. Nothing rough about it. No real judgment required. And yet we couldn't teach these young men how to do this nothingness. What was the difference? And I had to conclude eventually it was a difference of educational background. Fascinating. But that's what the principal difference was. That these standard issue ensigns, all of them weren't this way, by the way. I had a young chap named Navarro. I taught him to be a crack deck watch officer and a good navigator in 6 weeks. Everybody knows it takes about 20 years to get up to that. He was perfectly reliable. Smart cookie. I found out he was smart in other departments. Now, what was the essential difference? It was the kids I got for the Doris Hamlin, for the most part, hadn't cracked high school. They were faced by something. This is not really an interest factor because the ensigns were very interested in that ship, too. They were just as interested as these kids were. They just couldn't keep anything in their heads. These other kids, these ensigns, had been all the way through university, and they'd been taught everything except how to fix and unfix their attention. Got it? That's the only thing. And the longer they had been made to study something against their own power of choice, the less able they were to fix and unfix their attention at will. Got it? So I had to assume there was something destructive in education. There was something going on in education which defeated its own purpose. And if we use education in order to gain a skill, we will have to do this. Learn right along with it how to fix and unfix our attention on the subject matter. And then we can use it. But let's look at goals. If we're fixing and unfixing our attention solely to pass an examination, we'll find the material a few years later is of no use to us at all. That's the only reason we're doing it. The subject has a tendency to stay in the classroom. It's not used, it's not employed, no one has any recourse to it. Now, this can become so bad as an educational system that somebody coming along and actually using the information he's taught in the classroom becomes a freak in a class. So much so that the professor and everybody else will be certain he has studied the subject before or has had a professional experience with it. And there's where you get your ideas concerning how long you have to be educated in anything. If we know what we're doing in Scientology, we should be able to escape this factor. If a kid could be taught to be a top deck watch officer and a navigator in about 6 weeks, if a bunch of other kids could be taught the complexities of a sailing ship and how in the dark of night and rain and everything else to scamper up to the shrouds, the cross trees, and go through the complexities of sail handling and so forth in a matter of a few days, if these things could be done, then it is possible to educate somebody in something in a relatively short space of time so that he can use it. Well, I would say it would become as possible as it was possible for them to use the subject while they were studying it. You see how the difference would be? So therefore, they are fixing their attention on the theoretical and then fixing it on the practical, alternately, outside the classroom. And if we're doing that, we should be able to speed up an educational process markedly, because we're working this old saw. We were working with the materials which we're studying. And this is a very important step. All right, now let's look another way. Let's look this over from another viewpoint. Would an individual, be able to use his subject better if his total ability to fix and unfix his attention on data was bettered. See that? If he could totally fix his attention, just in general course of human events, by a course of study, if he could totally become more able in fixing and unfixing his attention, we would find him more capable of using the subject matter he was being taught, wouldn't we? It should follow that if he can fix and unfix his attention at will on bodies of data, use them or discard them at will, then it should follow that he would only have to study briefly if all the data he did study were then to be useful to him. He would be able to get along with less data, wouldn't he? If all the data he had, you see. Fixing and unfixing attention on bodies of data is very important. You should just look this over as a principle. I'll give you something like that. There are certain bodies of data, whether you have studied them or not, but I'll just give you a little drill. I'm not asking you to do this drill, by the way. It's fix your attention on arithmetic. All right, unfix your attention from arithmetic. Let's do that again. Fix your attention on arithmetic. All right, now unfix your attention from arithmetic. Is anybody still going 2 plus 2 equals 4, 2 plus 2 equals 4, 2 plus 2 equals 4? Huh? If you're not, then you can learn faster than other people. This is a simple test of the learning factor. And that's the way we test it. We ask a person to put his attention on a subject and then take his attention off of it and then check to whether or not it went on and whether or not it went off. That's all. And when we have done that, we have established the learning factor of the individual. And that's really all you have to know about the learning factor. Now, of course, on subjects which have proven dangerous to the individual, he is very often very stupid. Some subject that has proven terribly dangerous to him, when he fixes his attention on it, it attacks him. Now, he tries to get his attention off of it, and it just keeps on attacking him, and he becomes obsessed. And we have the factor known as worry. That's all worry is. A person fixed his attention on a subject and it attacked him. And when he tried to take his attention off of it, it went on attacking him. So now we have the figure, which makes worry. There isn't, this is the motto at this point, where he can't take his attention off of it is, there isn't enough space to escape into. The idea? So it's a matter of too little space. So we get somebody who worries always has too little space. See, he hasn't any space to fall away into. Now, this is quite important. If you really study a subject, you will regain an ability to fix and unfix your attention at will with the subject. If you study a subject, as you were probably led to believe you should study a subject in Western culture, you simply fixed your attention on it. You were supposed to learn how to concentrate. If you please, concentrate. What are we supposed to do? Go into an hypnotic trance? What are we supposed to do? Crowd our faces down into the pages of the textbook so that we crack the binding? What is this thing? Concentrate on it. Study hard. Work over it. Nah. Somebody doesn't mean us any good if he's telling us that. Because he's making the data unusable. The usability of data is the ability to fix and unfix one's attention at will from the data. Now, this is quite important. Quite important. Since data is knowingness. And if one can know and never not know, which is to say unfix the attention, one will get into this oddity. He will stick to every knownness. Just knowing something is enough to stick to it. The only thing that's wrong with him is his not-knower is out of whack. It has been discarded by his professors. His not-knower has been discarded. Somebody tore it up and threw it away. They said, you must never not know this information. This information is terribly, sweepingly, vastly, and engulfingly important. Get your nose in the textbook, bury it deeper, bury it a little deeper, now bury it much, much deeper, now never take it out. What good is an engineer who does this? You can go ahead and take your noses out of it. You thought this. Then Gramic. Do you see that education would be nothing if it did not retain flexibility of attention? And a little higher level, if it did not retain power of choice over attention and data. Fix or unfix. So obviously, the educational principles lie just there and just in that small sphere. Power of choice over the fixation or unfixation of attention. A person unfixes his attention by not knowing. He fixes his attention by knowing. So educational processes must contain within them, if the education is ever to be used, the ability to know and not know selectively at the power and direction of the person himself. And this then is good education, which results in a workable framework of action. And if you follow these tenets, you could, in a relatively short space of time, teach a fellow to do almost anything. His power of choice. Now, what if we're educating somebody against his will? We walk down and we see the college registrar. And the college registrar says you have to have umpteen and a half credits, units, in order to semester hour yourself through this. You say, what will I take? Well, he says, it's right there in the book. Of course, you have all manner of electives there, but you must have, 30, what is educational standards today? 21 hours of non-elective subjects, and then you can study what you please. This would be impossible, you see. You can just get along fine, and we will give you a degree as a Master of Arts if you just go along this line. And, of course, you will have to study economics. And you say, I have to what? And I say, well, you have to study economics to be a Master of Arts. It's absolutely necessary. It's absolutely essential. But you never use economics in the arts. Oh, you thought you were studying arts. Well, you're really not studying arts. Our arts courses are mostly science today. And you will have to have all these science courses in order to complete your arts education. Duh. See how silly this would be? And yet you look up this and you find that in selecting the curriculum, one is very liable to be up against an overthrow of his own power of choice. And if you don't believe this, stand outside the door of the registration office in any university in the world on registration day and look at the faces of the guys when they go in. Rather unconcerned, somewhat hopeful, and watch them coming out. Duh. They found out that they were all set in all departments except for German, and they had to have 8 years of that before they could get a degree in Swiss. See? So by election of subject alone, we could get an overthrowing of power of choice, you see. There'd be an entirely different system if one went at this from the principles that the power of the individual to unfix and fix his attention at will must be at all times retained if the subject in which he is being educated is ever to be used and applied properly and correctly. See, that would have to be maintained at all times. We would give him a list and we would say, this is what we expect a dentist should be able to use during his career of dentistry. And they would give you a long list. And when they got through, they would say, well, now, can you really fix teeth? And the fellow would say, yeah, I sure can fix teeth. Boy, can I fix teeth. All right, you're a dentist. Or they'd say, all right, fix some teeth. And he would, and they'd say, fine, you're a dentist. Get the idea? Doesn't look like the same system of education, does it? Well, I want to call very sharply to your attention that we're imposing another regimen on the student in Scientology, and if he is still working in the framework of fixed and unfixed, I mean, fix your attention and never unfix it upon this datum or that. See? You very well may take 80 years to learn Scientology if you're still studying it in this same way. But what we're trying to show you is these are the data, and there are now 4 or 5 years worth of data, all of which are important in a minor way, but some of which have become passé, and we say this is the data which an auditor should be able to use and with which he should have conversance in his application to the mind. You see that? And then we say to the auditor during training, well, run this, run that, study this, and study that, and you will find at your own choice this or that as you go through. If you don't find these things, then they don't exist there. But if you do find them, you do. All right. And we give him practical application all the way through training. At the end of that time, of that period of training, he should wind up with the only test that would have any validity passable, which, can he make people better or can't he? Well, if he can't, then maybe Scientology is at fault, maybe he is at fault, but we haven't got a good or confident auditor, have we? We would have been in vain. See that? A man does not come out of engineering school in the United States and get honors because he can build a bridge. He comes out and he gets his degree because he passed the examination. He had a paper accepted. And when this was done, he went out and tried to find himself a job. And the engineering firms the world around said, young man, when you get some experience and when you know what you're doing, having only spent now about 6 years with your nose to the grindstone, learning all about it, now when you know what you're doing and you can come up to the level of a common laborer, in our estimation, we will be happy to give you a job as a junior assistant to the cook. Now that's reality. Young man studies journalism. He goes down to the London Times, although I notice that more journalism students are on deck these days in newspapers than before, possibly because they're getting more practical. Because I noticed journalism classes have gotten more practical. But he goes down to the London Times and he says, I have just finished a major in journalism and I am now all set and here is my degree in journalism. And they say, fine, go over there and start clipping foreign newspapers. Why? This man took years to learn how to write a news story and so what? They say, well, he doesn't have practical application. Well, that's fine. But if this condition prevails, and I think all of you could discover very easily that it did prevail, if this condition prevails, then the real world, the workaday world, must long since have found something wrong with education. Long since must have found something wrong with it. Why can't you take a bright, shiny new student out of journalism class and put him at once onto the managing editor's desk? Why not? As a matter of fact, he'd drown, he'd die, he wouldn't know which end he was standing on. He'd go by the boards in about 24 hours. He'd be so confused he wouldn't know what he was doing. Because now he's being asked to fix and unfix his attention with such rapidity that it all looks like confusion to him. And that is the end result of losing the ability to fix and unfix attention. That's the end result, is confusion. You fix your attention on A, and then you fix your attention on B, and then you fix your attention on C, and decide you'd better unfix your attention off A, and you can't. You're still thinking about A, so therefore A, B, and C now sort of merge, and they become scrambled, and you get a picture of confusion. Therefore, you do not get an orderly system. All right, if a stable datum is necessary for the alignment of data, and if, as in the Dianetics logics, a science is a body of aligned data, then it looks to me like we've aligned everything but the guy. We've aligned the science, we've aligned his curriculum, we've aligned his course fees, we've aligned everything that we could align except the guy. Because if we'd aligned him properly, he would have been able to walk into the managing editor's job the first day he was out of school. He should have been known all about it. Now we get this sort of thing. We get a young chap. He's bright, he's got a steady hand, he's just fine, he's studied surgery, he's just all fine, and he goes into the hospital where he is, well, let's say he's interned in that hospital for some time, and at the end of this period of time, he goes in there as a staff doctor, and they very cautiously let him look at babies if he stays on the other side of a glass case. Everybody expresses the greatest possible confidence in him. They refer all cases of cut fingers elsewhere. You get the idea. I mean, the first days of his practice are days of uncertainty, both with regard to his colleagues and himself. That shouldn't be. That shouldn't be. The man, the first day of his practice, ought to be able to produce or do the most complicated heart operation you ever heard of with a steady hand with perfect aplomb. If he was trained right, he would be able to. So now I've pointed out to you and re-stimulated the bunch of educational boo-boos which exist in the society. Of course, you can say it's economically unsound to educate a journalism student, so on the first day out of school, he can step on and take over the managing editor's desk and do a bang-up job of it. That is unsound economically, because managing editors like to hold on to their jobs, and if every new student could take it over, this would be bad. No, I assure you that a managing editor who was a good managing editor would have one whale of a paper if every guy on the whole staff could take over his job at a moment's notice. This would be a terrific paper, and the odd part of it is it would be a terrific team. They would simply get the best managing editor. He'd probably stay there because guys are bad and good. But what then do we find could improve the educational system, and what then could improve an understanding of auditing as an educational system? What could do this? It would be a rehabilitation of the power of choice, first and foremost. Rehabilitation of the power to fix and unfix one's attention from bodies of data at will. That would be the second thing. Another thing would be to permit during study the application of the knowledge won in actual practice. And another thing, to retain and increase the certainty of the individual in his competence toward life. Just his general competence. To give him a better feeling of competence with regard to existence. If we did these things, we wouldn't have to train for 90 years. You see, we wouldn't have to train forever. But by the same token, if we did this job well, and you understand we're just practically, we've only been 8 or 10 months ourselves at this juncture here in 1955 on the road to knowing that we could train people. We've just been 8 or 10 months on this of a fairly good certainty that when we train somebody about something, why, they normally stay pretty well trained. And if we are able to adventure forward along this educational road and ourselves make a bang-up success of training auditors, training each other in the business of living, of aligning our own data with the data of life, not just the data of Scientology, removing our confusions and increasing our tolerances for confusions and lack of them, and increasing our power of choice clear across the boards, we would then have a new gift for the world. If we do this well and we learn how to do it better, we could probably assist people to make a fine surgeon in a few years rather than, I don't know, a man I think is considered a surgeon these days by education and so forth just about the time he gets palsy. The usable years we have in this man are few, simply because we have wasted too many of them in stumbling educationally with him. This is no criticism of a medical school or anybody else. It's just a criticism of our own. And remember, we own part of this society, too, and we're part of it. And when I say our own, I mean any part of the society anywhere. It's our own confusion on the subject of confusion and data, which has brought us up to a point where we would continue to tolerate fixation as a substitute for education. And we would ourselves, if we work this out, we may find this astonishing fact. We may find that we are able to make a good technician in the lower grades of high school. And we might find a boy at the age of 16, we have just made him just a fine technician, you see. He just might be wonderful, some line or another, very competent, very able. It may be that we could put somebody through all of his higher math or higher sciences or languages by the time he's 10 or 12 without straining his cerebellum the least bit. But all this would depend upon these factors, depend upon retaining for the individual his power of choice and rehabilitating his ability to fix and unfix his attention at will at his own choice. It follows that he gets an increase of tolerances of motion and no motion, and stupidity too. Now, fixing and unfixing attention is simply the skill of knowing and not knowing at will. You don't really lift your attention off as a solid beam and put it on something else, the way some people envision it. All you do is not know it. Therefore, drills and not knowingness are of the essence in rehabilitating the educational abilities. But techniques which directly rehabilitate power of choice are also of the essence. So either one of these, to not know at will, to be able to tolerate motion and lack of motion, to exercise one's power of choice, are all and seem to be at this time the principal factors involved in educating anyone well. And the oddity is, if this is the case, if we should educate them well in this wise, and that is the way we're going to do it, it would also then have a tendency to train them too, wouldn't it? It's a technique that goes along with this. Should you be able to exercise your power of choice, what would you choose? Such an auditing command over and over, run as a third level process, should produce some astonishing results. Very permissive question. You'd keep the question very permissive. If you could exercise your power of choice, or if you were going to exercise your power of choice, or if you wanted to exercise your power of choice, what would you choose? Not over any particular subject. You would be surprised how long this would run and how many subjects come up. He would eventually get hung up, probably, and you would have to push him off of the reef of survive, succumb. He would say, if I had a power of choice, I'd die, you know. You get stuck on that one. The file clerk always tells you, snap answer, die. You know. What would it do if you ran this engram? Snap answer, I'd die. Standard. Well, that's a power of choice, only it's not much of a power of choice when it's being foisted off on one. So we even have a technique that carries through this, as we have techniques that handle all of these factors. One isn't going to align any data in anyone unless one can free the individual's power of choice in what data he's going to have. I hope this has been some small benefit to you in clearing up your own viewpoints on education. Thank you.